can't see that. And to me, that's tragic. And if we...
We've run smack out of time. I'm
right,
sorry
well,
to tell you,
so
but thank you for your point about that.
You.
I think
thank
it's
you, Linda,
really
and thank
valid.
You
yeah.
To your guest. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes. And I want to thank my guest, too. Thank you very much, Joel Benin, Professor Emeritus of Middle East Studies at Stanford. We really appreciated your expertise this morning. And thank you, Reverend Montaigne, ED, for coming in and shadowing us and getting your first little feel of what it might be like to be a host here. And I want to thank our engineer, Asia, for getting it all set up. Thank you, all of our listeners, and we're now going to move on our Thursday morning.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month's screening is Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Honeyland chronicles a Macedonian woman's journey in strife while cultivating honey using ancient beekeeping traditions. Again, that's Honeyland on Thursday, March 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. Coming up next is the Women's International News Gathering Service. Press Watch is not going to be available today. Teresa's not here. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Afro Gallery, presenting The Ides of March, a pop-up on Sunday, March 15th, featuring local authors and artists, including Weird, the Zymoglyphic Museum, local artist Hello Kitska, Happy Fangs, and Hesher Park, and artist and author Stephen Leyba reading from his new memoir, We Are All Indians Now. More information is available online at Afru, and that's A-F-R-U, gallery.com.
Today on Wings from Chile. Patriarchy is a judge that judges us for being born, and our punishment is the violence you don't see. The cops, the judges, the state, the president, the rapist is you.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The 1,000 women in Santiago, Chile, on November 25th, 2019. The performance of A Rapist in Your Path was created by the feminist collective Las Tesis, inspired by the work of feminist Rita Segato. It has been performed in all regions and cities of Chile, and according to some estimates, in over 200 cities worldwide, such as in New York, outside the Harvey Weinstein trial.
And it's not my fault, not where I was, not how I dressed, and the rapist was you. And the rapist is you.
Kashmir. Turkey. Greece. Nairobi. One young lesbian feminist activist in Chile has participated in most of the performances around Santiago. Because of the violence and the fact that she works for the government, she's asked to be known as Dignity Wonder Woman. I had two long phone conversations with Dignity in January 2020. I knew Chile had had a feminist president until 2018. Michelle Bachelet was also founding director of UN Women and is now UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. So I asked Dignity, what happened in Chile to spark so many protests after the election?
The crisis has been increasing for years. Really, it's only needed the final screw. It was a thing of time and opportunity. It could have happened to her, to Michelle Bachelet too.
How has life changed since the election?
It's way worse. I am talking about rape, torture, and murder.
By the state?
Yes, by the state.
Who were they going after?
The people goes to the streets, say that the policemen shoot down the people. It's very simple. Don't say your voice in the streets.
There were protests before the performance, which is what you call it. What started those protests?
The transport is the most expensive in Latin America. But increase your price in very, very small cents. And the students, the secondary students, tell us that not pay the price. And into the transport with no pay. And a lot of people take this idea and not pay the transport. That happened.
You were talking before about the fact that workers in Chile are not paid well.
Yes, $300 is the minimum in Brazil.
That's the minimum wage, $300 a month?
A month.
A month. And I understand that the cost of living, things like food and rent and transport, are very expensive in Chile.
Yes, it's like Alemania or España. Includes España is more cheap than Chile.
So basically, it's cheaper in Europe to pay for food and transport than it is in Chile, and yet you earn a fifth of what is earned in Europe.
Yes.
Now, the protests, therefore, that happened before the performance was about increases in these sorts of costs that people could not pay them. What about healthcare and education?
In education, is a dramatic system with the elite, the people who is rich, take all the opportunities and work, and the other people not. It's a very simple. It's a country for the rich only.
Where do women fit into this? Are they worse off than before?
Yes. Yes, it's worse. Because the women always have been excluded. It's not easy for the woman because the repression is stronger with women. But we will know how to be there and impact in the streets in order to be heard and listen.
Is that what sparked the performance, that you felt that women were not being seen or heard?
Yes. Yes. Because of patriarchy of the elite. Yes.
Tell me about the performance. What does the blindfolds and the motions mean?
Everything is used because it was the police do with us. They literally left us blind and tied hands. When they stab us, they undress us and make us squat while threatening us with corrective rapes.
They call them corrective rapes.
Yes.
And who rapes these women?
The police.
And has anyone spoken out to international human rights organizations?
Yes, we have 4 international visits, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, etc. And see that, and we have the informers. Yes, see that.
Has there been anything that's changed as a result?
No.
Tell me about the police violence.
The police officers in Chile are brutal and relentless. That has not stopped us. We can determine it now. The police repress with toxic gases that contains agents that burn the skin and have other harmful effects. They are literally burning us. At the same time, they throw gas bombs. There are illegal detention, disappearance, the rape, tortures, and death.
You mentioned that people are losing their eyes. How is this happening?
Yes, a lot of... it's a very difficult for me to talk to about that because it's painful. They shoot a pellet that they ironically say were made of rubber. But after the death, we have seen and we know that it is not true. In addition, they not only shoot the body, but are a specialist in shooting the eyes. Official figures speak 352 people with permanent eye damage. And we know that those are not real numbers. Much more persons don't have eyes.
So what you're telling me is the police aim their bullets at protesters' eyes.
Yes.
And they are using gases that burn the skin.
Yes.
And that when they arrest women, they strip them down and frequently violate them as a form of, quote, correction, unquote.
Yes.
Do you have any idea how many women this has happened to?
No, I don't have numbers, but 800 people has formal denunciation to the police for sexual violence. 800.
Is that for this year?
No, until 18 October to today.
And that's all for these protests?
Yes.
In December 2019, the Chilean National Human Rights Institute, or INDH, issued a report listing the most serious human rights violations in 30 years, including more than 350 cases of eye loss and injuries. They've filed hundreds of legal actions against the authorities for homicide, torture, and sexual violence. Former President Bachelet did send a UN mission to investigate human rights abuses. Yet the UN Global Database on Violence Against Women cites for Chile official national statistics not available. On every form of violence that they track, official national statistics not available. And while the current Chilean president, Piñera, promised human rights abuses would be prosecuted, he has dismissed almost all incidences as isolated. What is the situation like for people in the LGBTQ community?
The situation is really worrying, and all the national and international organizations show the community LGBTQ+ is in danger since always. But with a lot of people in the streets, that is increasing.
Are there people in the LGBTQ+ community speaking out and obviously on the streets, or are they frightened?
They frighten, but that don't stop us, because the revolution is a moment of going out and tell that you need to tell.
Have the police been particularly attacking women in the lesbian community?
Yes.
Why are they targeting women in the lesbian community?
For the patriarchy, the policemen are very outrageous with people are different. Don't like the difference.
How many performances have you participated in?
10 or 20 performances.
Do you feel safe? You mentioned that the government is watching. Do you feel threatened by the actions of the government and the police?
A lot of frightened.
Have they been attacking women during the performances or after the performances? And what's happened when the police come?
The police, when we are doing the performance, see the performance. The performance is very short. And then the gas, then the bullet, then. During the performance, no.
Have you ever been arrested?
No, I run.
You're listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. I'm Mindy Ran, and I'm in conversation with a young lesbian feminist activist in Chile known as Dignity Wonder Woman. She's participated in most of the performances of A Rapist in Your Path in Santiago, which was created by the feminist collective Las Tesis. When we discussed recording this conversation, Dignity wanted to write something to explain what Chile is like living under the grip of the power elite. What follows are some edited excerpts from a piece she entitled Bad Type.
What is at stake today? Beyond how we are going to get out of this crisis, whether it's through a constituent assembly, by force or because of a massacre or another things. The issue is what kind of human being we are going to exalt now. I wonder, we are finally exalt joy, wisdom, goodness, love, and peace. Before choosing what structure you can get us out of this rage, this is a birth of a new social pact. Do we want to burn it all because we were burned before? They burned our dreams, our freedom, our poetry, our joy of life, our time of love. And I reflect from the ashes of the what kind of phoenix we want to erect. Is this a spiritual crisis that expresses itself in the social way? Maybe. The structure falls, but before falling, it must also die within us, the feeling that we have dignity, that we no longer have to ask for forgiveness, for existing, for wanting to be free of barriers that are finally also part of our construction as human beings. And now we ask ourselves in the streets, how is that so man generation work so hard just for crumbs, for this hunger that eats us inside? hunger not only for bread, but for love, because here there has been a great betrayal. We were promised progress, and that never came. So what now? That will depend on the price we are willing to pay. For as long as there are people who tell us, let's hug each other, let's cry for the fallen ones, let's dance the grief, the misfortune, and also the hope. The time may come when we can do all that is possible, but not like a pendulum coming and going, like two faces of the same coin that never meet each other. Tiredness is a good symptom that we can no longer eat what we are used to digest. Disgust prevents us from what can poison us. And in Chile, we say no more. We are disgusted with this reality. Hopefully, we learn from feminists. They tell us no means no, and let's no go back to our aggressor after the promised honeymoon as an apology due to the beating.
Bad Type, written by Dignity Wonder Woman. There is a bill just signed and referred to by Dignity as a peace agreement that agrees to put the question of a new constitution to a vote in April. But few trust the process or believe that the power elite will allow any real change that means the rich 1% will lose power. There have been calls for the entire government to resign on one side, while some call for even harsher repression on the other. You mentioned starting a new political party.
In the middle of the crisis, we need to change the constitution. We need put a lot of force, political force, told about the constitution, and some people is construct new political parties. But in the last days, the peace agreement for change the constitution, it was a very difficult moment, and we don't know or really change the constitution, because the political force has been with difficulties for talking. All the political forces are talking now. What is the exit to this crisis?
You mentioned this peace agreement. Is this between the government and the protesters?
No, the protesters has been out of the peace agreement. This is the problem. The political elite of Chile has signed a peace agreement, but this agreement makes things seem to change so that everything remains the same and the same as always, which have led us to this debacle, remain in power from the town and especially of the woman. We say no to the peace agreement, since without justice there is no peace. In this context, what we need is to change the constitution, which was created in military dictatorship, to finally give us a democratic framework where the people to decide what the rules of this new social contract are. In this way, what we are doing is activating ourselves in the neighborhoods to elaborate it, this new constitution, where the powerful will ask whether or not to change the constitution, but under its rule, which among many vices prevent women, native peoples, and independent persons who do not belong to the power established today to participate.
What is it that the Constitution stops you from doing?
Don't permit that women participate in equal conditions that men and the original or native peoples or independent persons don't permit with the rules.
So you have different rights than men do under the Constitution?
Yes.
Are you thinking about becoming a political person within the government? Do you want to do that?
now it's very difficult to see a leadership in the elite. We don't have leaders in the revolution. The people in the streets don't have heads who tell us who we are doing. It's a freedom revolution. We don't have leaderships.
What do you think will happen next?
We don't know. This is the problem. We don't know. Nobody knows. But the certain is the neoliberalism will be changed in all the planet. This is true, because neoliberalism implanted in Chile, but we see that it's come to death here in Chile. It's come.
Are you afraid that this will get more violent before it gets better?
Yes, yes. We expect a lot of violence, because the crisis is too great, to impact a lot of space of the human being lives, that the people say no more.
Is the government listening at all? What is their reaction to this?
The reaction is violence. No talking. No see, no, violence, only violence.
Do you feel that the political voice raised by the thesis and the performance has created enough momentum to create fundamental change?
Yes, it's a no more.
No more. I don't know if you've read, but women in Turkey were arrested for doing the performance.
Yes, for 2 years.
And that, yes, some of them have been threatened with jail up to 2 years.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
A lot of pain, a lot of anger. This is could be happening in the world today. It's just a performance. It's not violence.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about, I understand that a photojournalist, a young woman, was found murdered. Do you know anything about what happened?
I don't know, but it's really a mysterious place for death. I don't know how resolve this investigation. We don't know guarantee.
Are they going to investigate what happened?
Yes.
Was she covering the performances?
Yes.
So this is one of your group who has been murdered?
Yes.
Have there been others that have been murdered?
Now I don't know if we have other murder, but the violence is too old. It's very difficult to talk about.
Do you worry for yourself? You get a paycheck from the government, and yet you'd like to see the government change drastically and the people in the government gone. Does it worry you?
Yes, a lot of worry.
But you're not going to stop?
No, not going to stop. Nobody going to stop. This planet and is our planet, not the elite planet.
Our thanks to the bravery of Dignity Wonder Woman and thousands of other women for speaking out against sexual violence, and to Dignity for speaking to me. I'm Mindy Rann in Amsterdam for Wings.
El patriarcado es un juez que nos juzga por nacer, y nuestro castigo es la violencia que ya ves, es femicidio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Forgotten Island PDX on Friday, March 13th from 7 to 10:30 p.m. at New Expressive Works in Portland. Forgotten Island PDX is a hybrid film screening, concert, and sound performance centered around the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Again, that's Forgotten Island PDX on Friday, March 13th from 7 to 10:30 p.m. at New Expressive Works, 810 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now coming up on a special broadcast of Our Earnest Struggle, we celebrate the legacy of Frederick Douglass.
If there is no struggle,
there is no progress.
Frederick Douglass, orator and abolitionist, a man who needs no introduction. He teaches us that every real gain in the history of human progress has been born of earnest struggle.
Coming up,
Rochester, New York has a social justice history that is second to no city in this country. We need to get back to that.
We take a look back at one city's efforts to re-energize the legacy of Frederick Douglass. At the center of it all, a historic monument, the first ever to honor an African American.
Tonight, two men accused of vandalizing a Frederick Douglass statue.
We had no idea who the statue even was.
Our culture does not understand the value of African American people. But our presence here says that that is going to change.
All that and more on this episode of Our Earnest Struggle.
Frederick! Frederick!
One or two at a time. Come on from the left side, come on from the right side.
On a cold winter night in Rochester, New York, hundreds of people came out to get their picture taken with one of the city's larger-than-life residents, the 12-foot-tall monument of Frederick Douglass. With flashlights in hand, they waited for their cue from a team of professional photographers. In the resulting long exposure photo, Frederick Douglass looks out from his pedestal over a sea of blue and orange sparks, his arms outstretched. At one point, the crowd spontaneously broke into song. Then once more, with feeling. It was February 14th, 2018, the 200th anniversary of Frederick Douglass's chosen birthday. The photo shoot was one of the first events in a year's worth of festivities in Rochester, where the city came out in full force to show Douglass some love. After all, he's a bit of a hometown hero here, even if his connection to this western New York City isn't all that well known outside of it. Douglass launched his abolitionist newspaper, The North Star, in Rochester. He raised his family in Rochester. He's also buried in Rochester. And within a few years of his death, the city put up a statue to honor him.
As you know, Highland Park is now the home of the first monument ever erected to honor a black man in American history. And I am still overwhelmed by that.
That's Carvin Eisen, project co-director of the Re-Energizing Douglass Initiative, speaking at the Douglass Bicentennial Kickoff.
That is something extraordinary.
Rochester's statue to Frederick Douglass went up in 1899. It was placed downtown near the city's bustling train station.
At the time, Mayor of Rochester George E. Warner said, and I quote, "It is fitting that it should stand near a great portal of our city, where the thousands who enter it may see that she, Rochester, is willing to acknowledge to the world that her most illustrious citizen is not a white man."
Rochester's monument to Frederick Douglass went up at a time when other cities around the country were starting to build monuments to Confederate soldiers and leaders.
Many of our national monuments have become tools of division.
The year before the Douglas Bicentennial, one of those monuments served as a rallying point for a resurgent white nationalist movement.
Since the city voted in April to remove the Robert E. Lee statue, there have been three protests, counter-protests, and now violence.
32-year-old Heather Heyer died when a car...
Men waving Confederate and neo-Nazi flags and armed with shields and clubs.
As the saying goes, the past is never dead. It's not even past.
Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Those people were also there because they wanted to protest the taking down of a statue of Robert E. Lee.
Both the statue of Robert E. Lee and the statue of Frederick Douglass are weapons in an ongoing ideological battle over the past and how it's remembered.
When Douglass dies in 1895 and the statue goes up in 1899, there's really the sense that there's a whole series of public battles still to be fought over the American soul.
Richard Newman is a scholar of abolition history at the Rochester Institute of Technology.
Confederates, from the moment the Civil War ends, are engaged in an ideological battle over the things which the Confederacy was dedicated to, which of course relate to states' rights, agricultural economies, but at their core revolve around bondage and slavery in a certain place for African-descended people. So when you see these people in the 1870s and the 1880s, building memorials to Confederate leaders, publishing histories of the Confederate cause, and trying to, in a sense, relitigate the war, what they're saying is, we're battling for the future memory of the past.
In Rochester, it was the African-American community that led the way in making the Frederick Douglass Monument a reality.
African-Americans are trying to put this history back in front of people through histories, monuments, speeches.
And there's one very persistent man in particular who stands out as one of the unsung heroes of that whole undertaking. His name was John W. Thompson.
John W. Thompson's another one of these Afro-Rochesterians that deserves more limelight. He's a working-class figure, works in the hotel and hospitality industry. He's active in the Masons. He's a member of a black church. And in many ways, he's an heir of the tradition that Douglass fought for, that abolitionist vision of the United States, which saw African Americans as equal citizens. So in the 1890s, he thinks that African Americans are being left out of this memorial tradition of honoring Civil War fighters. Even in the North, some of the monuments that are going up in the 1880s and 1890s are about white soldiers, white leaders. And so he wants to have this statue in Rochester as a kind of parallel memorial to what black soldiers did in the Civil War. And he really doesn't get a lot of traction. He gets some support, but when he goes to the state legislature, they're not really interested. And so he reaches out to Douglass to try to draw in this great celebrity and hero of his. And Douglass says,
"I shall be proud if I shall live to see the proposed monument erected in the city of Rochester, where the best years of my life were spent in the service of our people, and which to this day seems like my home."
That's local history buff Andrew Williams reading a letter Thompson received from Frederick Douglass.
Thompson was able to use this to convince the powers that be in the city of Rochester to go along with his idea.
Andrew Williams, like Thompson before him, has spent much of his adult life trying to put the history of Western New York's African-American leaders in front of the public.
While I was living and working in Albany, they had an exhibit on life in New York. And I said, there's not much African-American history in this exhibit about New York State. And they said to me, "What are we missing?" And I said, "What are you paying?" Okay, that was my entry into museology.
Williams says, growing up in a predominantly white suburb of Rochester, he didn't know much about the area's African-American history outside of what he learned in church. It was only after going to college in Auburn, the Western New York town where Harriet Tubman settled, that Williams began to discover the hidden history his teachers hadn't taught him.
When I came back to Rochester, I went to my history teacher, and I said, "How come you never taught me my history?" And he apologized and said, "It wasn't part of the curriculum and I didn't know it." So I accepted his apology after he took me to lunch.
In the 1980s, Williams went on to work as an outreach specialist at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It was there that he first became interested in J.W. Thompson, after stumbling across a photo of the Frederick Douglass Monument in the collection.
And he was standing next to the ladder going up to the monument. And I wanted to know who it was. And fortunately, the librarian already knew the story. And she said, that's John W. Thompson. He wrote a book about the monument. And I'm like, oh, do we have it? And she says, of course we have it.
Williams was instantly hooked.
And so I was so impressed that this waiter at the Powers Hotel, first of all, wrote a book, and that he documented everything about the making or building of the monument. And I tried to imagine someone in their 20s conceiving of this idea and then working it to completion.
J.W. Thompson worked tirelessly to raise the $10,000 needed to build the monument, and it wasn't easy. Most of the donations were for modest amounts, although one contributor came through in a big way.
Thompson wrote a letter to Haiti, their ambassador to the United States, and in response, the country of Haiti sent a check for $1,000, and that was the largest contribution of the $10,000.
J.W. Thompson ended up commissioning the monument from a company in Rhode Island. But as the day of the dedication approached, there was a bit of a snag.
The statue was actually en route on the day it was supposed to be dedicated.
So that must have been a huge blow for Thompson.
It was. In fact, he wanted to cancel the dedication. But thousands of people were already planning to be there, and thousands of people showed up. It was phenomenal.
Among the many prominent individuals who attended the dedication for the empty monument were journalist and activist Ida B. Wells. Susan B. Anthony was a guest of honor. Douglas's family was there as well. The following summer, a proper unveiling was held. The 54 Massachusetts, the African American regiment Douglas helped recruit soldiers for during the Civil War, also attended. Among other tunes, they played Marching Through Georgia, the 1865 song celebrating Union General Sherman's decisive military campaign in the Confederate stronghold. The unveiling ceremony was the culmination of 5 years' worth of work by Thompson and his planning committee.
It's in its end result, Douglas is a metaphor for Black contributions to America and the Civil War. But in its beginning, it's really about adding something to the memorial culture that's missing. African-American soldiers. John W. Thompson was fighting far more than for just a memorial to a Black leader. He was fighting against a culture which was trying to, again, segregate and marginalize African-American people.
For Andrew Williams, J.W. Thompson deserves more recognition as a profile in persistence and civic engagement.
You can have an idea that can inspire people to do what has never been done before, and that if he could do it then, I can do what I need to do now.
Among the projects Williams is working on is a children's book about the monument and the hotel waiter who helped make it a reality.
I would like to have a book that circulates the city school district, in particular Rochester City School District, and the suburban schools as well, because that's where I grew up. And so if I can hook up with an illustrator and move from there, it'd be like Thompson and his proposal. But I would love to have it illustrated and produced here in Rochester.
When we come back, we'll find out how the Re-Energizing Douglas Initiative used public art to get the city of Rochester to see itself in a different light. Stay with us.
My name is Brennan. We're going to read the letter that I wanted to send to my school so we could change the name to Anne Marie Douglas. Anne Marie Douglas should be the school's name because she worked at home and on the Underground Railroad. She also helped Frederick Douglass escape, and she's very brave. And when Frederick went away for 2 years, she took care of the family.
How did you learn all this stuff?
This is our earnest struggle. I'm Darian Lehman. It was a bright October day. Contractors had been hard at work for most of the morning, hoisting Rochester's historic Frederick Douglass Monument onto the back of a truck, piece by piece. They were in the process of moving the larger-than-life abolitionist to a more prominent spot in Highland Park. And when the crane operator lifted the final 1,500-pound piece into the air, they discovered there was more.
What are we looking at?
Time capsule.
What's left of it?
Oh, yeah, definitely looks like some newspapers from when it was encapsulated.
Sadly, the metal box was pretty beat up, and the contents were completely waterlogged. Thanks to J.W. Thompson, though, we know what the Monument Commission had put in there over 120 years earlier. Pamphlets from the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention that Douglas had signed onto, a map of the county, copies of local newspapers, among other things, had been placed inside the cornerstone back in 1898. Even though the time capsule couldn't be salvaged, many observers found the relocation of the statue on that crisp October morning pretty exciting in its own right.
Something special happens when you take a big physical bronze sculpture with a ginormous crane and move it across the sky, okay?
It was just a magical moment when it flew up in the air, literally.
Over the trees and put it on a sidewalk, and then you stand next to it.
It's just, it is almost beyond comprehension for me to see it there.
This wasn't the first time the monument was moved. In 1945, it was transported from its original location downtown to the city's Central Park near the site of Douglas's last home in Rochester. But in 2018, as the bicentennial celebrations unfolded, elected officials decided it deserved a more prominent location in the park, complete with benches and a small plaza right on the street. For Carvin Eisen, project co-director of the Re-Energizing Douglas Initiative, the relocation of the monument represents the final culmination of an ambitious public art project revolving around that statue.
It comes full circle. All the great work that we did, the monuments that Olivia created.
As part of the 2018 bicentennial celebration, Eisen commissioned local artist Olivia Kim to produce 13 life-size replicas of the statue that were then placed around town at sites where Douglas lived and worked.
This sculpture's meant a lot to me.
Kim says she got to know the original pretty well during that process.
I stared at it quite a lot, trying to get the right attitude. My first encounter with the sculpture was on a scaffolding in the middle of the winter. It took 3 hours to take 80 measurements, all by hand.
Kim says the initial plan had been to replicate the statue using a 3D printer.
We tried to have the sculpture digitally scanned, but it was a very rough scanning, and it would have taken just as much time to digitally fix that scan to make it appropriate to do a digital printing as it would for me to do it by hand. And I gotta say, I'm glad I did it by hand. And when it came to making the 13 sculptures, physically making them, we had an empty studio, and about 150 volunteers came. Most people not even knowing how to do sculpture or anything like that at all. They learned on the spot and helped me make these sculptures.
In keeping with a tradition established by the original statue's sculptor, who had brought in Douglas's son Charles as a model for the statue's hands, Olivia Kim called on one of Douglas's living descendants to sit for her.
Frederick Douglass's three times great-grandson and Booker T. Washington's two times great-grandson, I believe, Ken Morris Jr., posed for the hands of the sculpture.
Those hands, Morris likes to say, had touched those of his great-grandmother, who in turn had touched the man with the big white hair, as she used to call him.
And I had this thought that hands that actually touched the great Frederick Douglass also touched mine. So in a sense, even with all of those greats, I can say I stand just one person away from history, and I stand one person away from slavery.
For Eisen, one of the overarching goals of the Public Art Initiative has been to reconnect Rochester with its own history, especially its history of social activism. It's a side of the mid-sized city that lies hidden, or maybe just dormant. As RIT professor Richard Newman says, Rochester became better known as the city of Eastman Kodak and of Xerox, as a white-collar town. But, he says, it wasn't always that way.
In the 19th century, Rochester was known as a great reform metropolis. Of course, it had a manufacturing foundation because of the Erie Canal and railroads and the Great Lakes. But from the 1820s onward, it was known up until Douglas's death as a great city of reform. As a matter of fact, one of the world's great cities of reform. And that's why Douglas spends 25 years from here, and that's why his family wants him to be buried here. he feels comfortable here. It's where he grew up and became an independent entity. It's where he felt that in many ways the American Republic before the Civil War and the end of slavery really saw a future version of itself, because you had reform advocates who were espousing temperance, equality for workers, philanthropy, but also, and most importantly, civil rights and women's rights. And Douglass participates in both of these causes for decades. So after the Civil War, Douglass, but also Susan B. Anthony, are known as, you know, Rochester's first citizens. And then in the early 20th century, of course, Eastman and Kodak kind of run away with it. And we see this turn from a social justice city to a business city, a city that's based on not only business, but information technology, based on innovative technology, based on efficiencies.
In just 61 years, radiology has developed from nothing to a position as one of the key tools of the medical profession. Important contributor success of this branch of medicine have been the companies which supply its materials, like Eastman Kodak of Rochester, New York. Here in the department where emulsion is applied to X-ray film base, employees are perhaps the cleanest factory workers on earth.
That's what George Eastman symbolizes. This is a better industrial way, a paternalistic industrial way that benefits white-collar workers. Buffalo up the road is an industrial powerhouse. You know, it's a brawny city. It's like Chicago. Rochester is more of a white-collar city. It's New England. It's technical. And so that's what Eastman really symbolizes powerfully in the 20th century. But I think in terms of public memory, there's a real problem there, because Eastman isn't up to the task necessarily of civil rights reform, of women's equality.
Not only was Eastman not up to the task, recent historical research has revealed the extent to which his company contributed to the racial segregation and inequality that came to define Rochester in the 20th century. The housing stock that was built for Eastman Kodak workers and their families? The original deeds for most of those properties contain restrictive covenants, clauses forbidding the sale of the property to African Americans. Shane Wiegand is an area social studies teacher who's been researching the history of discriminatory housing and lending practices in Rochester during the Eastman Kodak Golden Age.
Starting in the early 1920s, Kodak was one of the big people that did these restrictive covenants. They built neighborhoods like Meadowbrook, where there was 371 homes, all of which had restrictive covenants barring people of color from ever living in there.
In 1920, Eastman founded ESL, Eastman Savings and Loan, to help Kodak workers finance those homes. At the time, Eastman said, quote, "I want to make Rochester, for the thousands of people I have gathered here, the best place on the face of the earth to live and bring up their families," end quote. But for the thousands of African Americans who moved to the city during the same period as part of the Great Migration, well, that's another story. According to Wiegand's research, 1958 was the first year the bank Eastman founded approved a loan to a black person. It was also popularly said that the only job for a black person at Kodak during those early years was behind a broom. Systemic racism in housing, lending, and employment, combined with the policing required to maintain the racial order, contributed to Rochester becoming the site of one of the first urban rebellions of the 1960s. The 1964 uprising first broke out only blocks from the original site of the Frederick Douglass Monument.
The riots grew out of an incident following a street dance at the corner of Joseph Avenue and Nassau Street just before midnight. A policeman had tried to arrest a man for public intoxication. Negroes claimed a canine dog bit one of them, setting off the explosion.
During the civil rights era and into the 1970s, so-called urban renewal programs put highways through black neighborhoods, facilitating white flight to the suburbs while further cementing the racial and economic segregation that characterizes American cities to this day.
As in most American cities, the tendency here in recent years was a withdrawal from the central core to the surrounding suburbs. People first, then business, headed for the open spaces.
One of the legacies of racial and economic segregation in Rochester today is the chronic underfunding of the city's public schools. Only around 60% of children in the Rochester City School District graduate. One in 10 public school children is homeless.
Just last month, EdBuild did a study that found that Rochester's boundary between Rochester and Penfield is the most segregated school district line in the entire United States. Really speaks to what the results of these restrictive covenants, redlining policy, And it's just left us with a community in Monroe County that is incredibly segregated.
Against this background, it was all the more outrageous when, in 2019, this happened at the site where Frederick Douglass attempted to enroll his daughter in school.
Tonight, the city of Rochester is on edge after a statue of the famous abolitionist Frederick Douglass was ripped down only 30 days after being placed at
Both men accused of attempting to steal the statue are football players at St. John Fisher College.
In a Facebook conversation with News 10 NBC, Milks tells us, "Me and my friend were just drunk. This was not racially motivated. We had no idea who the statue even was."
The two white college students who vandalized one of the replica Frederick Douglass statues pleaded guilty to fourth-degree criminal mischief, a misdemeanor. In exchange, they went through a restorative process and agreed to pay to replace the $10,000 statue they destroyed. While the local district attorney touted this as a victory for restorative justice, many community members doubted that a young black man accused of a similar offense would have been afforded a second chance. What's more, the fact that the vandalized statue had marked the site of the school where Douglass's daughter had received discriminatory treatment was not lost on community members either. When the moment came to unveil the replacement statue, Carvin Eisen invoked this history of injustice.
Place has memory. It was on this site, right near here, that Frederick Douglass had to lobby for his daughter. His daughter, Rosetta, was at the school, enrolled in the school, but she was segregated from the general population.
Rochester City school student Eric Daniels then read from an account Douglass published in his newspaper describing the treatment his daughter, Rosetta, received.
Instead of receiving her into the school, according to the agreement, she was merely thrust into the room, separate from all the other scholars. And in this prison-like, solitary confinement received the occasional visits of a teacher. On my return home, I asked her, "How do you get on at the seminary?" She answered with tears in her eyes, "Father, Miss Tracy does not allow me to go into the room with the other scholars because I'm colored." I went immediately to the seminary to remonstrate with the principal against the cruelty and injustice of treating my child as a criminal on the account of her color.
We are Frederick Douglass.
This wasn't the only instance of racism the Douglasses experienced during their 25 years in Rochester. Most notably, in 1872, the family's barn and house caught fire and burned to the ground while Douglass was out of town. When he arrived home by train, he couldn't find where his family had gone. And as rain poured down, he was turned away at a local hotel because of his race. Authorities deemed the fire an accident. Some hypothesized a jealous black man might have set it. But Douglass was unequivocal. The arson was an act of racial terror. Rochester also has its share of the Ku Klux spirit, he wrote. And that same year, he and his family left Rochester for good. There is an ongoing ideological battle over the past and how it's remembered. That includes the city of Rochester itself, as a city of social reform and abolitionist activity, but also as a city of racist segregation and discrimination. Frederick Douglass once said, "We have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future." So, as the 202nd anniversary of Douglass's chosen birthday has come and gone, have we made it useful?
As an activist, I think Douglass would really challenge us to think about what we're doing on the activist front. It's all well and good to say this would be Douglass's 200th birthday, and we've got a great statue in Rochester that honors him, and people in other parts of the country are talking about tearing down their lost cause and Confederate statues, and we're trying to build up this image of Douglass as a great abolitionist and reformer. But he might really look askance at us and say, "But there is so much in your world that you have to change. And why don't you get busy with that right now?"
We knew that it was a courageous political act to put a monument of an African-American man on the streets of an American city, even if that man is Frederick Douglass and even if that city is Rochester, because our culture does not understand the value of African-American people. But our presence here says that that is changing, and that is going to change.
The story we want to tell about ourselves is Rochester is the home of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. We stand for civil rights and freedom in Rochester, but we're also one of the most segregated cities in the entire country. My hope is that there would be a real movement around housing in our community that kind of starts some with education, but churches, community groups, individuals would really come together and demand housing equity and integration.
In the modern world, we still have to deal with injustice in education, right? In criminal justice, in healthcare, in employment, and in housing, and in every dimension of our life, where we will stand and we will not allow this monument to be desecrated. We must also stand up for all of those other issues, because those are the issues that we face right now.
That does it for this episode of Our Earnest Struggle. For Rochester's Community Media Center, I'm Darian Lehman.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein reviews the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to uphold Trump's stay in Mexico policy.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
From the Excelsior at the top of San Francisco's historic Mission District, this is Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the U.S. Supreme Court upholds Trump's deadly stay in Mexico asylum policy, further jeopardizing thousands of Central Americans fleeing the death squads and now highly vulnerable to the new current viral pandemic. Also, Cuba providing crucial